Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Thomas Reed, a former Secretary of the Air Force during the Ford and Carter administration. He was the youngest ever director of the super-secret National Reconnaissance Office and was a special assistant to President Reagan for national security policy. His technical background includes nuclear weapons design at Lawrence Livermore and low-temperature physics. And his books include At the Abyss, An Insider's History of the Cold War, Nuclear Express, A Political History of the Bomb and Its Proliferation, and his latest just out is Tehran Triangle. Welcome to Background Briefing, Thomas Reed.
Ian, wonderful to be back with you. You are very perceptive. Your audience is too. It's great to be back.
Well, thank you, Thomas. Now, you were very, very involved in the Cold War, which, you know, did end. It's one of the, I think, one of the greatest, most positive things in history was how that frozen, in seemingly intractable relationship that was so dysfunctional because both sides, the more money and treasure they spent on arms and nuclear arms, the less secure they became. Many thought that we could have, and indeed, the record has never been quite fleshed out in terms of how close we came to nuclear war. It's bad enough to have a nuclear war on purpose, but to have one by accident is pretty hideous. But what is so troubling is that this new landscape that we're in now, that we seem to have the worst of both worlds in as much as we have psychological disarmament between the United States and Russia, although they physically they still have lots of weapons pointed at each other. But my understanding is, and I'd like to get your response to this, is that we're in a new landscape now where it's actually more likely that a nuclear weapon's going to be used than it was during the Cold War, which was predicated upon the use of nuclear weapons.
I think that's very perceptive that the Cold War ended. There are, there were heroes in ending it. There was the economist like Harry Rowan of the Intelligence Council who understood the Soviets were going broke and we could end it, and we did. But we're now in a different world. And the problem specifically with Iran that I have thought about and written about is that the Iranians really are not deterred. The Soviets did not believe in the hereafter. The nomenklatura had a good deal. They enjoyed their perks. They wanted to stay alive. The Iranian mullahs are very different. They believe in the tough imam. They would be willing to go to brink. They're not crazy people, but they are not as deterred as the Soviets were about the possibilities of a nuclear detonation.
But why would deterrence not apply to them, given the robust nature of the Israeli arsenal? And presumably that seems to be their number one obsession is Israel.
Their political obsession is Israel, but they're not going to go nuke Tel Aviv. No, they're not crazy people. The problem is that once Iran gets nukes, that's going to inspire a nuclear spiral in the Mideast. Saudi Arabia, Egypt, and Turkey are Sunni nations. They'll go nuclear very quickly. Iran will become a bully. They will control half the world's oil supply. Israel's existence will be in doubt by virtue of political action, Hezbollah in Lebanon and so forth. Iran is not going to go physically attack Israel, but they're going to, Iran would disable the military ability to protect its allies, and the worst of all is Iran would be willing to go to the nuke in political episodes and confrontations with the U.S. Navy, because the view of the leaders are, if worse comes to worst, that is not a terrible thing, that the 12ers, that are the mullahs, really think that they believe in the end of days, and if it all comes with fire and flame, why, that's the way it is. Our gods in heaven will protect us.
So my understanding is that both the CIA and Mossad say that Iran hasn't made the decision to build a nuclear weapon, that they're at least 2 years away from that.
Well, Ian, time has two dimensions. First of all, yes, they made the decision to go nuclear decades ago. The question of actually assembling one, that question has two dimensions. One is time, the other is technology. If you were talking about having a warhead that you can put on a missile and is compact and weighs 100 pounds, that's an engineering challenge. But the other axis is technology. If you're willing to deliver it by boat or train or truck, then all you need is 140 pounds of highly enriched uranium, and you can build a Hiroshima-type bomb in your machine shop. That's what they wrote about.
Well, but my understanding is that, I don't know whether it's a speculation or fact, but I've tried to talk to non-proliferation experts, and there is a suspicion, more than a suspicion, that the AQ Khan network provided the Iranians with a Chinese design, that it's a fairly mature design. Is that your understanding?
Absolutely. The technology started further back than that. It started in South Africa when the South Africans decided to go nuclear. They canceled that program in 89, and AQ Khan went and harvested all the engineering talent to recruit into his network. One of the things that AQ Khan also acquired was the design for what's known as Chick-4, the Chinese very simple implosion enriched uranium bomb. He had that bomb. We found those drawings in Gaddafi's papers when Gaddafi decided to fold his nuclear tent. And there's no doubt that he is offering that design to other nations.
So just in terms of the South African angle, Thomas Reed, my understanding is that I think it was September the 22nd of 1979, during the Carter administration, when you were the Secretary of the Air Force, there was a nuclear event, as it's called, off Namibia in the Atlantic. And I understand that that was a joint South African-Israeli test of a thermonuclear trigger.
In my opinion, the opinion of the nuclear weapons laboratories and my writing partner in Nuclear Express, Danny Stillman from Los Alamos, we all are the believing that that was the test of an Israeli nuclear device. It was done with South African logistic support, that I don't believe it was a joint design, that when they folded the program, the president of South Africa made statements that strongly suggested that they were not involved in design. There is a committee that was impaneled by the Carter White House that says no, it wasn't really a nuclear shot, and some very respectable people signed that report, but I disagree. I think the September 79 was a detonation of a 2-kiloton Israeli device with South African logistic support.
Do you think it was a thermonuclear trigger?
Well, that's a little hard to tell. There's no hard intelligence, but from what Stillman and I looked at, our conclusions were that it was a neutron bomb. It was
That's pretty much the same thing, isn't it?
A thermonuclear trigger implies the A bomb you need to fire a thermonuclear.
Right, but
a neutron bomb means it's two stages, and it lights a second stage that is all fission, and it creates a lot of neutrons. And we think that's really what Israel needed for its tactical considerations, and that's what they shot.
Right. Well, that was my understanding, too. But there was no quid pro quo, you're saying, between the Israelis and the South Africans. And that the South Africans, when they dismantled their program, a lot of the intellectual capital ended up with AQ Khan? Is that what you're telling us?
Well, let's back up. You know, there was a quid pro quo. The agreements were signed in April of 75. We have copies of the signed pages with Shimon Peres and the headman in South Africa. Basically, the quid pro quo was Israel would provide technology to South Africa along with a supply of tritium, which you need for triggers and other things. In exchange, the South Africans would provide uranium because it's a byproduct of gold mining, so they had it piled all over the place, and they would provide the wide-open spaces of the deserts and their ocean territories for testing. That was the quid pro quo. The resulting product was the Israelis gave the South Africans advice on how to build nuclear weapons, but I do not believe there was a joint nuclear weapon. But what happened when the South Africans folded their tent in 89, they had a whole bunch of people, not that were just bomb designers, but they were engineers that know how to make centrifuges. That's what AQ Khan collected, is the engineers that understood how to make centrifuges, the plumbing and the joints and the balance and all that technology. And that's what he began to proliferate to other places, including Iran.
Well, those centrifuges are obviously a very complicated piece of engineering. I think they spin at something like 78,000 RPM. But my understanding is that the Israeli Stuxnet computer virus really did put a crimp in the Iranian centrifuge program. But I've also been told that that they've overcome it, and they've got thousands of them operating in these arrays.
No, you got exactly the right word, Ian. The Stuxnet virus put a crimp into the Iranian program. It slowed it down. You're right. Centrifuges have to spin at well over 78, maybe as much as 100,000 RPM. That the Stuxnet virus basically got the centrifuges to overspeed and fly apart. That the Iranians are busy fixing that. But one of the people in charge of fixing it was one of the scientists that was blown up by a car bomb attached by a motorcycle. There's a tough war already going on.
So is it possible that you can, in between the possession of potential fissile material or real fissile material and not building a bomb? Because I understand the Swedes in the 60s went up to the brink and then pulled back and decided they didn't want to do it. Japan has an enormous amount of plutonium. Presumably they have the ability to design weapons. A lot of people think that they could go nuclear very quickly, and that's one of the concerns about North Korea, is that if things start to escalate there, and as you mentioned earlier, the real problem with Iran is that the Saudis will then want a weapon. They could probably buy one from Pakistan, who knows? But, I mean, it obviously is going to escalate. So let's take the Japan model. Can you live with that in this 21st century?
Japan example is exactly right. Japan could go nuclear within a year. If a nation has reactors, if they have engineering talent, if they have resources and money, then they can go nuclear within a year. Japan clearly could do that. The principal reason they don't is they rely on the U.S. nuclear umbrella. Same thing with Germany. That's one of the important things of the U.S. nuclear inventory, is to assure our allies. That you're right. The Swedes had a nuclear program. They decided to quit. The Swiss had one. They were planning 8 shots under the Alps, and they decided it was a waste of money. But they could go. But they were starting from fundamentals. But Japan has the reactors. They have the material. Same thing with Iran. Iran does not have reactors, but they have centrifuges. They have the material, and all it requires is the decision to put it together. As mentioned earlier, if you wanted to do a missile warhead, that takes some sophisticated engineering. If you're going to deliver it by a boat or a truck, it does not take engineering. That's World War II technology. Anybody can do it. All it's required is a political decision.
Well, we could talk on for a long time. I'm afraid, though, Tom, that we're out of time here. So, again, I recommend your book, and I just hope that the worst doesn't happen. But I must say, after having been a student of the Cold War, and of course you were deeply involved in it, that was one of the best things that ever happened, was that ended. But then a whole new landscape of subnational and transnational threats have emerged, and nobody seems to have a handle on it.
That is true.
Well, I thank you again for joining us.
Ian, I appreciate you having me. It is really challenging times, and it's been a delight talking about it. Thanks for asking.
Well, thank you. Again, I've been speaking with Thomas Reed, who's a former Secretary of the Air Force during the Ford and Carter administration. He was the youngest ever director of the Super Secret National Reconnaissance Office and was a special assistant to President Reagan for national security policy. His technical background includes nuclear weapons design at Lawrence Livermore and low-temperature physics, and his books include At the Abyss, an insider's history of the Cold War, Nuclear Express, A Political History of the Bomb and Its Proliferation, and his latest book just out is The Tehran Triangle. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking with the director of a new film about the president of an island that is sinking due to global warming.
So let's surprise them. We'll drop the big one, pulverize them. The Asia's crowded, Europe's too old, Africa's far too hot, and Canada's too cold. South America stole our name. Let's drop the big one. There'll be no one left to blame us. We'll save Australia.